At 7:30, Joanne Bowman hosts Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. At 9 on the Thursday Radio Zine, the guest is Heather Rogers, author of Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage. At 9:30, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Jim Thompson interviews Maestro Stefan Minder, former conductor of the Portland Opera, along with his wife Edith. At 10:30 on Art Focus, Julie Bernard interviews Annie Dubinsky, Assistant Director of the 3D Center of Art and Photography. And be sure to join us at 11 for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.
Good morning, this is the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, January 12, 2006. I'm Carlos Chavez. Coming up in London, the trial of a Muslim cleric with ties to Oregon is getting underway. The confirmation hearings for Samuel Alito continue today, although the outcome is fairly certain. Meanwhile, the centerpiece of the Republican power structure, Alexander Strategy Group, is crumbling beneath the weight of the Abramoff delay investigation. And in Jerusalem, Ariel Sharon is in stable, though comatose condition, and it's back to politics again as the March elections loom. Portland area weather, rain developing, snow in the mountains. Very windy along the coast, temperatures in the upper 40s to lower 50s. Tonight, rain, lows in the mid-30s to 40s.
A key Republican lawmaker is demanding that Governor Kulongoski and state officials present a plan next week to wipe out the $172 million gap facing the programs for low-income elderly and disabled Oregonians. State Representative Dennis Richardson of Central Point says failure to come up with a plan would amount to political dereliction of duty. Richardson heads an Oregon House task force that heard testimony from local social service agency officials about how the budget gap occurred. Richardson said Kulongoski must be prepared to spell out details of his budget fix when the Legislative Emergency Board meets to talk about it on January 19th. The governor has said there is no need to rush into a solution and the problem can be handled without making drastic cuts in services for the poor.
Former State Labor Commissioner Jack Roberts says he will run for the Oregon Supreme Court seat, being vacated by retiring Chief Justice Wallace Carson. He plans to formally start his campaign today at an appearance in Eugene. Roberts has two law degrees and was a practicing attorney for a decade in Eugene. In his political life, he served as a Lane County Commissioner and Oregon's Labor Commissioner. Roberts ran for governor in 2002 but lost the Republican primary to Kevin Mannix. Roberts is currently the executive director of Lane Metro Partnership, a job growth advocacy group based in Eugene. Roberts said last September that he was considering a run for the court. At the time, he told the Register Guard newspaper that Carson's departure would leave the court without broader elective experience for the first time in 30 years.
Church leaders and consumer advocates are urging legislators to crack down on Oregon's booming payday lending industry. The industry is accused of charging soaring interest rates on short-term loans. But payday lenders say they serve a need, charge less than banks collect for bounced checks, and are sufficiently regulated by market competition. Oregon is one of only a handful of states with no caps on interest rates. Short-term payday and car title lenders regularly charge 521% annual interest on small loans. This from the Oregonian.
A federal judge has cleared the way for lawsuits claiming sexual abuse by priests to move forward in Portland after more than a year and a half. Those suits have been on hold since July 2004, when the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Portland became the first diocese in the nation to declare bankruptcy. The ruling yesterday by U.S. bankruptcy judge Elizabeth Paris will allow trials to proceed for as many as 100 alleged victims, including the one whose pending trial forced the archdiocese to seek protection from creditors. Paris said she believed that lending juries decide damages would help the parties come to an agreement on a settlement.
A A new report released today by scientists, former Forest Service employees and conservation groups indicates that logging within the Biscuit Fire area of southwest Oregon is costing the public both ecologically and economically. According to the Facts and Myths of Post-Fire Management, a case study of the Biscuit Fire, southwest Oregon, the Forest Service has lost approximately $14 million in sale preparation and administration costs on logging projects in the Biscuit Fire area. This finding undercuts the agency's frequent argument that logging is needed to generate revenue to pay for other activities. According to the report published by the World Wildlife Fund, the public needs to know that post-fire logging is a lose-lose proposition. The taxpayer loses by footing the bill, and the environment loses by damaged soils and degraded fish and wildlife habitat. The report found that the Biscuit logging project expedited logging but would not have made a difference in dollars and cents because of the steep terrain and difficult access. The study team documented extensive damage to the area's regenerating forest, especially in the Fiddler Late Successional Reserve due to excessive logging. A special concern was the loss of larger trees in logged stands, as these trees are the building blocks for future forests and are critical to fish and wildlife species. The cumulative effects of yarding, hauling, and fuels treatment on wildlife habitat, soils, and water quality will likely persist for decades. The report warns that damages from post-fire logging operations could become widespread if the House and Senate adopts expedited post-fire logging legislation introduced by Congressmen Greg Walden, Brian Baird, and Gordon Smith.
A small earthquake this morning caused the ocean floor off the Oregon coast to roll a bit. The U.S. Geological Survey reported that the preliminary magnitude earthquake was 4.9. The agency said the quake occurred at 2:02 a.m. and was centered 150 miles west of Coos Bay and 18 miles below the ocean floor. Officials said they doubt anyone ashore felt it. Some people cite the event as clear evidence that locating a liquid natural gas facility on the Oregon coast is a very bad idea.
The Portland City Council began its fight against the EPA over treating Portland's water yesterday. KBOO's Andy Seaton has the story.
The Environmental Protection Agency now requires cities to filter their water for cryptosporidium under a new rule adopted last week. However, the Portland City Council claims this treatment is both unnecessary and costly. It may even be harmful. Commissioner Randy Leonard says why they're fighting it.
It would require us to filter for cryptosporidium and potentially cover the reservoirs. We, for a variety of reasons, vehemently disagree with the federal government's rule.
The city is hiring the law firm of Foley Hoag to fight the EPA. Interim Water Bureau Administrator David Schaff outlines why they were selected.
They have extremely valuable experience in challenging previous EPA actions. This particular firm was involved in a case that's well known among water utilities in Boston, where it successfully assisted the local water authority to avoid an EPA mandate to filter its water supply.
Commissioner Dan Saltzman questioned why the city was challenging the EPA. David Schaff responded.
We have a number of different strategies, including seeking a variance on the rule.
Then Commissioner Eric Sten questioned the long-term outlook for Bull Run, including adding a third dam at Bull Run.
I think there's one kind of strategic piece, and I just want to put it on the table, that I think this lacks, and I think it's critical, and I think that you guys need to figure out how to address it, which is where you want the water system to go. That being said, I don't want to ever see us in a position where we don't recognize that we're going to need a filtration system at whatever point we expand the Bull Run.
Randy Leonard pointed out that getting a third dam built would be politically impossible.
I do not know how you ever get a proposal through in the era of 2005 that would have such a dramatic impact on the ecosystem up there.
Cascade Anderson Geller of the Friends of the Reservoirs pointed out that filtering is not as benign as it sounds.
When you do the filtration, you have to add coagulants to the water to make it completely clear. So in other words, to get out tannins, if you have color in the water, which doesn't hurt the water, you have to add coagulants. These coagulants put into the water acrylamides. Acrylamides are now regulated by the EPA because they're cancer-causing.
The council voted 4-0, with Sam Adams absent, to sue the EPA and hire Foley Hoag. The city is on a short timeline to file its lawsuit against the EPA. Their initial challenge is due by February 19th. I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
New Orleans officials unveiled a controversial recovery plan yesterday. The plan gives residents 4 months to prove they will rebuild in a devastated city before their neighborhoods could be declared off-limits to redevelopment. The plan calls for a much smaller city, estimating that just half of the 500,000 people who lived there before Hurricane Katrina will resettle in the next 2 years. It proposes residents and experts from planning teams for each neighborhood and decide by late Monday on the fate of those most heavily damaged by the storm and flooding that followed. It was designed by the Urban Planning Committee of the Bring Back New Orleans Commission. For a neighborhood to be ruled viable, half of the residents must commit to come back. A moratorium will be placed on rebuilding in badly damaged sections, such as New Orleans East, the waterfront Lakeview, and the poverty-stricken Lower Ninth Ward. The proposal drew loud boos and shouts of anger from residents who crowded a downtown hotel meeting room for its announcement. If a neighborhood is not deemed habitable or too few residents return, the city could ban redevelopment and turn it into a park or open space. Property owners would be compensated in a proposed federal buyback program that would provide 100% of their homes' pre-storm value. The concept of getting rid of certain neighborhoods altogether has angered many black residents of the Lower Ninth Ward who fear theirs is among the most likely to be closed down, this according to Reuters.
Prosecutors in the Abramoff delay proceedings are entering a new phase of the corruption investigation in Washington. They are focusing on a lobbying firm that's been with even closer ties to Tom DeLay. The firm, Alexander Strategy Group, is of particular interest to investigators because it was founded by Edmund Buckman, a close friend of DeLay's and his former chief of staff. The lobbying firm has been a lucrative landing spot for several former members of the DeLay camp. ASG openly promoted the idea that it could deliver access to legislators. Now, ASG's connections with DeLay have resulted in its virtual dissolution. For years, Alexander Strategy was one of the crown jewels of the so-called K Street Project. The project is an effort Republicans began after taking control of Congress in 1994 to dominate the lobbying industry. The hope was for Republican lobbyists to harness the power of their corporate clients to help keep the party in power for years to come. The successful history of Alexander Strategy since its founding in the late 1990s offers a window into the nexus of Abramoff, DeLay, and the lobbying world over the last decade or so of Republican control of Congress. This from the New York Times.
Yesterday, Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito was confronted with questions by members of the Senate Judiciary Committee on abortion, executive power, and other contentious issues. Alito was asked repeatedly by Senator Richard Durbin whether the Supreme Court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision establishing a woman's right to an abortion is the settled law of the land. Alito would neither agree nor disagree. Instead, Alito said, it is a precedent that has now been on the books for several decades. It has been challenged. It has been reaffirmed. In response to questioning on the term settled from Senator Dianne Feinstein, Alito drew an ambiguous line on where he stood. On executive power, Alito said the president is not above the law and cannot lawfully direct the FBI, Justice Department, or anyone in the executive branch to violate the Constitution. Durbin and Senator Edward Kennedy tried to delve further into Alito's membership in the conservative organization that opposed the admission of women and minorities at Princeton University. On the role of the judiciary, Alito said the judiciary is checked on a daily basis by its own should while making sure not to step over the line into legislating or administrating. Alito addressed criticism that average citizens may not get a fair shake in front of them in cases where the government is one of the parties, but his response appeared less than forthcoming. Generally, Democrats played a well-coordinated offense game, while Republicans, led by mascot Jeff Sessions of Alabama, functioned as cheerleaders.
President Bush said yesterday that he isn't bothered by congressional hearings into his domestic spying program as long as they don't aid the enemy. In the days after the secret wiretapping without warrants was revealed, Bush cautioned against hearings. He said that congressional leaders had been privately consulted and that he'd worked within the law to authorize eavesdropping on Americans with suspected ties to terrorists. Senate Judiciary Chairman Arlen Specter has promised hearings on the issue, and the Senate Intelligence Committee could also investigate. House Democrats have asked their Intelligence Committee for hearings, and Democrats in the House Judiciary Committee plan to hold a forum on the monitoring program's legal ramifications on January 20th. In Louisville, Bush hosted a casual town hall-type event reminiscent of his campaign stops. Bush paced with microphone in hand like a talk show host in front of signs that left no doubt about the administration's message of the day, winning the war on terror. After his opening remarks, Bush fielded about 10 questions from the audience of invited groups. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan said the questions were not pre-screened. Bush said no topics were off limits and even invited a question about Iran, but nobody asked one. Instead, the audience wanted to know about the war, terrorism, and a host of domestic issues, including health care, education, and immigration. Bush acknowledged differences over the war on Iraq.
A woman scuffled with flight attendants and another passenger on a United Express flight yesterday, then claimed a bomb was on board after the plane was diverted, authorities said. No bomb was found aboard the aircraft, which left Eugene, Oregon, for Denver, but was diverted to Salt Lake City. The woman was charged with interference with a flight crew. Magdana Georgieva threw a passenger into the aisle, began yelling, tried to remove her shirt, and threw items at other passengers, court documents said. The pilot diverted the plane to Salt Lake City. During landing, Georgieva ran toward the cockpit and was stopped by flight attendants, with whom she got into another scuffle. Passengers subdued her. After the plane landed, Georgieva tried to run from police and said there was a bomb on the aircraft. The plane was evacuated and checked for explosives. Passengers were allowed back, and the flight continued to Denver. Georgieva was sent to Salt Lake City Hospital for evaluation. It was not clear whether she had an attorney. She is to appear in court today. The charge carries a maximum of 20 years in prison.
Billionaire investor Kurt Kerkorian sent a stern message to General Motors. The message was cut wages from the boardroom to the factory floor, chop costs by selling the Saab and Hummer brands, and adopt a sense of urgency to survive. This according to the Detroit Free Press. With General Motors burning through $24 million of cash a day, the company will run out of money in 1,000 days or sooner unless executives make tough decisions now. Kerkorian aide Jerome York said, until now, Kerkorian and his representatives had not spoken publicly about GM and had not interfered in management of the automaker. Kerkorian made billions from his investment in Chrysler, but last year he lost hundreds of millions of dollars on his stake in GM as the stock price lost nearly half its value. GM lost nearly $4 billion through the first 9 months last year, and although its automotive operations have about $25 billion in cash at their disposal, the company could burn through that amount in 3 years or less.
The Interior Department yesterday opened nearly 500,000 acres of federal land in an ecologically sensitive area of Alaska's North Slope to oil and gas development. The department said it would allow oil development in virtually all of the wetlands surrounding Lake Teshekpuk in the northeast corner of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The lake region includes one of the most important molting areas in the Arctic for wild geese, an area sought out by caribou herds for calving. The plan calls for opening 7 leasing areas from 45,000 acres to 60,000 acres to oil and gas development. The government estimates that the areas surrounding Lake Teshekpuk contain about 2 billion barrels of economically recoverable oil and 3.5 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. Most of the territory was open to development in the 1990s, but not the 4.6 million acre northeast section that includes the ecologically sensitive Lake Teshekpuk region. It had been expected that most of the northeast region also was slated for leasing, but environmentalists had hoped to keep oil rigs out of the region around the around Lake Teshekpuk. The BLM concluded a year ago that the oil and gas exploration in the northeastern section can be conducted with minimal impact on the area's wildlife. The decision Wednesday represents a final go-ahead for such development.
A court yesterday convicted a man of trying to assassinate President Bush and the leader of Georgia by throwing a grenade at them during a rally in May of 2005. He was sentenced to life in prison. The court also convicted Vladimir Aryutyunyan of killing a policeman in the course of an operation to arrest him several weeks after the incident. The grenade that Aryutyunyan threw during the huge rally attended by Bush and President Mikhail Saakashvili landed about 100 feet from the stage where they were standing behind a bulletproof barrier and did not explode. No one was hurt. Aryutyunyan's trial began last month and acknowledged that he threw a grenade in the direction of the stage and said he would try again to kill Bush if he had the chance.
A man who claimed he killed a retired police officer because he thought the A on the victim's University of Alabama baseball cap meant he was the Antichrist has been sentenced to death. Green apologized at his sentencing hearing to the families of the former officer, James Hallman. The jury that found Green guilty in October recommended 10-2 that he be put to death. The death sentence will be appealed automatically. Green had testified during the trial that a talking bull, religious signs, colors, and symbols influenced him to shoot Hallman. He was initially declared mentally incompetent, but underwent treatment and was found competent for the trial. He also had received treatment at a mental facility before the shootings. His relative said Wednesday that sentencing a mentally ill person to death was cruel and inhumane.
The 14 protesters charged with unlawful assembly during the World Trade Organization protests in Hong Kong appeared in court yesterday. FSRN's Dante Tozzo was at the hearing and files this report.
14 protesters charged with unlawful assembly during the World Trade Organization protests in Hong Kong appeared in court today. FSRN's Dante Tozzo was at the hearing and files this report.
At today's hearing, prosecution dropped charges against 11 of the 14 protesters for lack of evidence. The three remaining protesters, all Korean farmers, will face trial in March. One is charged with unlawful assembly, while the other two are charged with unauthorized assembly. Both offenses are punishable by a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison. The legal defense team for the farmers say there's evidence that indicates two of the accused were absent from the scene during the time of the alleged offense. The three farmers are free to return to Korea after their release on $4,000 bail. Pre-trial review is set for February 6th, and the three are due back in court on March 1st. From Hong Kong, this is Dante Tozza for Free Speech Radio News.
U.S. Ambassador John Bolton
Israel.
Warned... U.S. Ambassador John Bolton warned U.N. members yesterday that the United Nations cannot play a global leadership role unless it establishes a new human rights council that bars countries that carry out rights abuses. Bolton spoke at closed-door negotiations on a new human rights watchdog to replace the current Human Rights Commission. The commission has been widely criticized as an irrelevant body that is powerless to stamp out abuses because its members include some of the worst offenders and it has no mandate to punish violators. Bolton said the United States wants the 53-member commission replaced by a council with a maximum of 30 members, chosen primarily for their commitment to human rights by a two-thirds vote of the General Assembly. The United States has agreed to the concept of universal periodic review of the human rights records of all countries. Earlier this month, Bolton told reporters all five permanent Security Council members, the United States, Russia, China, France, and Britain, should have the right to sit on the new Human Rights Council. Russia and China questioned this, and he didn't mention it in his speech.
A radical cleric with ties to Oregon allegedly encouraged his followers to kill Jews and other non-Muslims in taped sermons found in his home after his arrest. The Egyptian-born cleric was a head preacher at London's Finsbury Park Mosque. The mosque has been linked to terrorist suspects, including alleged 9/11 plotter Zacharias Moussaoui and Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. Al-Masri is charged with multiple counts of inciting the killing of Jews and other non-Muslims, using threatening or abusive language designed to stir racial hatred and possessing a terrorism-related document, the Encyclopedia of the Afghani Jihad. The book included instructions on how to make explosives and carry out assassinations. Al-Masri, who has pleaded innocent, faces a maximum sentence of life in prison if convicted.
Gunmen stormed an offshore oil platform run by Royal Dutch Shell in Nigeria today and seized four foreign oil workers. The workers were kidnapped late Wednesday from an anchored supply vessel at Shell's EA oil platform in shallow waters off the southern Niger Delta and taken to an unknown location, the Shell officials said, on condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to speak to the media. He had no other details, and the nationalities of the kidnapped workers were not immediately known. Britain's Press Association reported at least one Briton was believed to be among those kidnapped, citing an unnamed company official. Local communities in Nigeria have been demanding a greater share of revenues from the oil flowing from their land for years. Hostage taking is common, and kidnapped workers are usually released unharmed. Shell workers running the EA platform have been taken hostage twice in the past year over a dispute with neighboring communities who accused the company of reneging on a promise to undertake development projects for their impoverished region.
Israel returned to politics today as Prime Minister Ariel Sharon remained comatose a week after a massive stroke. The Central Committee of Sharon's forsaken Likud party was expected to choose a list of candidates today for March 28th national elections, with polls showing the party losing more than half its strength from the last vote when Sharon was the leader. The same polls show the Prime Minister's new party, Kadima, maintaining a huge lead despite, or perhaps helped, by his illness. Sharon's successor as Likud leader, ex-Premier Benjamin Netanyahu, ordered his party's cabinet ministers to quit. But Israel media reported that the four ministers would ignore the order, plunging the hardline movement already reeling from Sharon's defection into further disarray. Netanyahu had planned to withdraw the party from the government, but suspended the order following Sharon's massive stroke January 4th. Uncertainty over Sharon's condition has clouded Kadima's campaign plans. KBOO Morning News for Thursday, January 12, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO's volunteers and volunteer audio engineers edited the tape. And KBOO's intrepid reporters contributed local stories. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director. Boone Rivas is on the board right now. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Carlos Chavez.
We welcome your participation in the AM Newsroom. To volunteer, call us at 503-231-8032, extension 202, or reach us by email at amnews@kboo. Or drop by the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. The KBOO website is www.kboo.fm. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264 AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220 HR. Be sure to join us at 5 p.m. for a solid hour of solid news on the KBOO Evening News. Portland area weather for today, rain developing, snow in the mountains, very windy along the coast, temperatures in the upper 40s to the lower 50s, tonight rain, lows in the mid-30s to 40s. Coming up on the KBOO Morning News Program and Public Affairs Programming, at 7:30, Joanne Bowman hosts Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. At 9 on the Thursday Radio Zine, the guest is Heather Rogers, author of Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage. At 9:30, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Jim Thompson interviews Maestro Stefan Minder, former conductor of the Portland Opera, along with his wife Edith. At 10:30 on Art Focus, Julie Bernard interviews Annie Dubinsky, Assistant Director of the 3D Center of Art and Photography. And be sure to join us at 11 for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.
Good
this is the KBOO Community Calendar for Thursday, January 12th. There will be a documentary film tonight at 7 p.m. showing at the Hollywood Theater, which is located at 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Brick by Brick, Side by Side, follows the efforts of a 2004 work brigade from the U.S., which features 10 members from Portland, Oregon, helping a community in Nicaragua develop clean water projects. This premiere is a benefit for the nonprofit group El Porvenir, which has worked for over 15 years to bring sustainable clean water and reforestation projects to poor communities in Nicaragua. Local filmmakers Lonnie Jo Lee and Roger Lee will be on hand to answer questions about these working vacations and how this film came about. There will be a suggested donation of $10, although everyone is welcome to attend, regardless of ability to pay. For more info, contact Lonnie Jo Lee at 503-234-6812. From May 19th through May 28th, the 6th Annual Village Building Convergence, or the VBC6, will give Portland residents the chance to come together and further enhance the communities that make Portland so special. VBC6 provides many opportunities to become involved and to learn more about community building, sustainable living, green construction, and urban permaculture. City Repair invites you and your community to propose a project for the 2006 Village Building Convergence. Projects can be place-oriented, ecological, artistic, structural, social, and even alive. The main goal is to promote cooperative community-based efforts to reconnect with each other and to enhance the places we live. Details on previous projects, the proposal process, and requests for proposals can be found online at www.cityrepair.org or at City Repair Headquarters, which is located at 2122 Southeast Division, or you may call 503-235-8946. The 2006 Village Building Convergence is sponsored by the City Repair Project, Southeast Uplift Neighborhood Coalition, KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio, and the City of Portland Office of Sustainable Development. The World Heritage Student Exchange is seeking local families interested in providing a high school exchange student a positive encounter with the U.S. Students are aged 15 to 18 and come for the 2006-2007 school year. For more info, contact Cayenne at 503-356-4901 or at 800-888-9040. You can also visit them on the web at www.world-heritage.org. Thanks for listening to the KBOO Community Calendar for Thursday, January 12th. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Hood River, and Corvallis.